This is the Press Pass with Chris Ryan.
This is where you hear unique conversations with the best athletes, coaches, and general managers in sports.
I think you appreciate each and every one. Each and every one is special in their own way. And
I play with two guys that they were on top of their game on a nightly basis, and people get spoiled. You know, they saw Manny, they saw David, so they start taking people for granted.
An opportunity for me. I know I need to help my team now, so you know, the better I play, the better it'll be for us.
I think it's one of the most important things is focus and consistency.
Welcome to the Press Pass here tonight, the Thanksgiving weekend edition of the show. I am Chris Ryan, Press Pass presented by Douglas Leonard and Garvey. If you've been injured, the most important decision you're going to make is who your lawyer is going to be. I encourage you to check out Douglas Leonard and Garvey at nhlawoffice.com. Patriots take on the Texans in a matchup of division leaders on Sunday Night Football in Houston. Patriots, of course, coming off the 13-9 win over the Cowboys last week. They have the best record in the AFC at 10-1. Patriots have been held to 20 points or less, though, in the last three games after scoring at least 27 in all but one of their first eight contests. So, you know, we've highlighted the offensive struggles for the Patriots. Texans bounce back from a blowout loss to the Ravens by beating the Colts 2017 last Sunday. And they have won five of their last seven games. They are 7-4 atop the AFC South. Houston has beaten New England only once in the 11 all-time meetings, including the playoffs. Here's Patriots head coach Bill Belichick on Texans QB Deshaun Watson.
He's very, very good. He can, you know, make, he's a very accurate downfield passer. He's made some great throws, double moves, seam routes, post patterns, go routes. Of course, we all know he's a very athletic guy with the ball in his hands.
Belichick says the Texans are an explosive team. Patriots wide receiver Philip Dorsett says they're still improving in week 13 of the season. Dorsett expected to return to the lineup after missing last week with concussion symptoms.
Getting better every day. We're working hard every day, and I think we can. It's good that we can get better at things, and at this time of the year.
One of the great stories around the Patriots and person you always love to be around is Matthew Slater. He says he's grateful for his career and teammates after so many years.
I'm thankful to just be playing the game of football, and to be playing the game of football with some great men. You know, I'm thankful for the relationships that I have with my teammates. For me, at this stage of my career, you know, that means more than anything.
More on the Patriots a bit later. Celtics split two games against the Brooklyn Nets. Kyrie Irving did not play in either one of the contests. And, of course, that drew a lot of ire from Celtics fans who had paid for the right to boo Kyrie Irving in his return. Kyrie nursing a shoulder injury, also alluded to his mental health as well. In an Instagram post, and so Kyrie was not there in Boston. Celtics lost to the Nets on Friday in that contest. Boston overall now 13-5 on the season, in the third spot in the Eastern Conference, two games behind the Milwaukee Bucks for the top spot in the East. They will be in New York to take on the Knicks. They stay down in NYC, take on the Knicks on Sunday at 3:30. Boston Bruins continue to be absolutely amazing this year. You know, there's been stretches here and there. The Bruins haven't played the best, but you know, the stretch they're on right now is a pretty special one where they played three games in less than 4 days and won all three of these games. Granted, you know, the teams they're playing, perhaps not the best, but the Bruins are now have 41 points. That is the most in the National Hockey League. And they are 18-3-5. They are undefeated in regulation in their last 10 contests. And they beat the Montreal Canadiens 8-1. I was at that game up in Montreal. We'll have more on that in just a moment. But the Bruins won in overtime against the New York Rangers today in the annual Black Friday game down in Boston. Beat the Ottawa Senators 2-1 as well, erasing a 1-0 deficit in that contest. So the Bruins, you know, continue to roll, and this is a special Bruins team. And one of the reasons they're special is because of what David Pastrnak is doing this year. He has 24 goals in 26 games, including a hat trick against the Canadiens in Montreal. And I talked with the head coach of the Boston Bruins, Bruce Cassidy, about the type of season that Pasta is having. Again, 41 points in 26 games, 24 goals in 26 games, on pace for 80 this year.
He's learned to get inside a little better than in the past. That's probably due to his physical maturity. Been through a couple of playoff rounds and knows how important that is, that You don't have as much time and space. You got to, you know, work to the net. So I thought he did a good job on the second one. You know, it was a one-on-one where he, you know, he worked his way into the good ice against a good defenseman, got his shot off, you know, was willing to, like I said, get inside. The first goal is typical pass in the power play. He's been hitting those well all year. Last one, just good hand-eye coordination. Probably got a little lucky, but, you know, when you're on the front of the net, those things happen.
From a historic perspective, what do you see what Pasta's doing nearly a goal game at this point?
In what sense? Like his history or the NHL history? Or
NHL history and his as well.
Well, I mean, he's on pace for, what is he, 80, 82 or 80 or so? Yeah. I mean, that'll be historic for the Bruins, obviously. But for him, I think he's just showing up to play every night. He shoots when he's supposed to, still making plays. He's not cheating. He's not scoring goals just by, you know, avoiding the defensive responsibility. So I think he's playing the right way while he's doing it. Obviously improved in the, you know, his one-timer's been rock solid from day one. So the power play's a threat every time he goes over the boards. But like we just talked about, the other goals, he was trying to get inside, attack the net, got to the front of the net. So he's a stronger person. You know, he's still a young guy, so every year he gets a little more mature physically, and I think, you know, with his speed and his hand strength, he's always had that. As an 18-year-old, I had him in Providence. He was always winning pucks, but now he's able to stay on his feet longer and absorb hits, and I think that's why he's had more success this year.
Hockey interviews on the program brought to you by the Concord Youth Hockey Association. Get your youngster playing hockey by going to the Concord Youth Hockey Association website at concordyouthhockey.org to learn more. Again, that's concordyouthhockey.org. Also talked with Pasta himself after his hat trick against the Canadiens.
Just your feelings on what this does for the team to come in here and push forth this type of performance?
Yeah, well, obviously it was a big win for us, especially, you know, after the last game here. They're going to come strong, and they're a good team, really fast, and good for us that we was able to stick with our plan and, you know, get the 2 points.
Three different goals for you, three different ways. What does it say about your goal scoring that you're able to highlight, you know, those different skill sets?
I don't know. You know, this is one of those games, I guess, and I don't know, what does it say?
Do the second and third goals highlight some of your development as a goal scorer, though, that, you know, one-on-one and then getting in front of the net and getting position and then deflecting home?
Yeah, maybe, you know, second goal, you know, I at first I wouldn't take it wide, you know, kind of try to go, but it wasn't available, so, you know, just try to get it quick on net, it got in, and the third goal, you know, Brenner found me all in front and you know, made a great shot on purpose for tip and you know, good heads up play by him.
David Pastrnak right there, and there is no, you know, place in hockey that is like Montreal. And I know the Canadiens haven't won Stanley Cup in like 26, 27 years at this point, but there is still no place like Montreal, and to do it on that stage, you know, just shows where Pasta is going right now. An individual who made his NHL debut is 20-year-old Jack Stadnicka, who, according to individuals in Providence, has been the best player for the Providence Bruins this year. He gets the call, and he looked a little overmatched at times. He played against the Rangers as well here on Friday. But he's got his first NHL assist. It came on the Bruins' eighth goal of that contest. And after the contest, we talked with him about his NHL debut.
I was actually a lot less nervous than I thought I was going to be. So after the first couple shifts, I felt more comfortable.
Was there a particular moment where things just kind of settled for you, or was it just getting those shifts under your belt?
Just getting the shifts under my belt, I think. Get the first one out of the way, second one out of the way, go from there, and then just keep getting more comfortable.
What were your biggest lessons and takeaways from the game? You mentioned some of the issues early on, but do you feel like you settled in and met the pace and tempo?
Yeah, like I said, as the game went on, I think I got more comfortable and was able to play my game, show my skill set, and just looking to get better every time I hop on the ice up here.
All right, now time for an in-depth conversation with the Bruins' Torey Krug. Krug and Carlo are arguably the number one defensive pair for the Boston Bruins, but Zdeno Chara is going to the Hall of Fame, and Charlie McAvoy has a tremendous upside, so very often that's considered to be the number one pairing. But to be quite honest, you know, they are interchangeable, and it's been interesting to see the dynamic that exists with Krug and Carlo. Now, Krug gets the lion's share of his points as the point man on a power play unit, which is incredible, But he also is able to create and makes a significant impact playing along Brandon Carlo. Bruins, of course, are playing incredible hockey at this point. They have the most points in the National Hockey League. Here is my conversation up in Montreal with Torey Krug.
What have been your impressions of the way the team has played to date with guys in and out of the lineup, along, obviously, run of the postseason? Have you been impressed with what you guys have done throughout the course of the regular season so far?
I think I'm, you know, mostly impressed at our ability to win in different situations, different games, different lineups, for sure. At the same time, we've been relatively inconsistent. So we got to find a way to grab a hold of our game and just inch forward, you know, game by game, and feel better about our 60-minute efforts. But we're finding ways to win, and that's the most important thing. And that's what happens when you see, you know, championship teams. I know we didn't win it, but you get that swagger. You get that you're comfortable in different situations. You're down a goal. You're down two goals. You're up by three. You got to find ways to win, and we've seen it all so far this year.
What do you view has led to that, the ability to find ways to win? Is that a veteran thing? Is it a, how do you, what do you kind of put your finger on?
Yeah, I think it starts with the veteran group, the older guys, and all of a sudden when you see that, you know, their never give up attitude, you know, you're down but you're never out. You see the way that they approach each shift. There's always another play to be made. I think it spreads like wildfire throughout the locker room, and all of a sudden the younger guys, you know, they feel that as well, and they continue to work and learn, and all of a sudden you have a great team.
At what point did you and Brando develop the chemistry that you guys have? And was it an on-ice thing before it was an off-ice thing? And how do you kind of categorize your relationship?
So the year we lost to Tampa in the second round, I think right around January, February is when I think our games start to take off. And, you know, on the ice, it was just a matter of knowing where each other are at all times, understanding habits of each other, and you know, he knows what I like to do, I know what he likes to do, where he's going to be. I can make blind plays without having to look up and see where he is, and I think that part, you know, started to take off like that. And then obviously our run through the playoffs last year gave us even more confidence, and then, you know, we enjoy getting those bigger matchups against top end guys, and we enjoy being that pair, and we just put our head down and go to work. We don't care who all gets the accolades, and we just try to do that. But off the ice, he's always been just a great, respectful, humble kid, and I've just enjoyed, you know, I don't know if he'd call me a mentor, more like a good friend, and I just kind of show him a few cool things along the way, and he's been really respectful, humble. He's a great kid.
For you to be you, how important is it to have, you know, him there? Or not just him, but anybody that you can have, you know, the trust in, that you can take chances from time to time and still know that he's going to be there for you?
Yeah, I think the stability thing is extremely important for any guy in my position to have success. They have to have that partner that they're comfortable with, and they know that, you know, he's going to put out fires if I end up creating one. And I think that's a guy that I have right now. He does it, you know, better than a lot of guys in this league. He can end cycles like, you know, no one else I've seen before, and he's so long, he skates so well. He's just a great defensive player, so it's really important to have that stability factor. Now I don't have to second guess my decisions, and it allows me to play more instinctive and on the balls of my feet instead of back of my heels.
In 13, when you came in, you had obviously the phenomenal postseason, and over the last couple of years, you obviously rounded out into one of the best defensemen in the league. Do you see the correlation between playing with Carlo as being a big part of that, and the confidence side of things, or is it just, you know, you played well those years, but perhaps statistically things didn't go your way?
I think it's a combination of a few things. I think having Carlo there is developing that chemistry has been extremely important to my success and how I've been able to produce otherwise. Secondly, I think the development of our power play has been lights out, and it's been so much fun to be a part of that and watch the chemistry grow and grow. And you know, to watch Pasta and Marshy kind of pull into their own, and what they do on the ice, all I have to do is put the puck in a good position for them, and as long as they're getting the puck with time and space, they're going to make things happen. And
I think just years past, we haven't had teams that have been as good, and that's what you see. Results are, at the end of the day, everyone likes to look at numbers, and if you're not winning, if you're not producing, then people just assume you're not playing well, but that hasn't been the case.
Sweet. Thank you.
Right, that is the Bruins number 47, Torrey Krug, joining me here on the Press Pass on KXL. Hockey interviews presented by ConcordYouthHockey.org. And this show tonight presented by Douglas Leonard and Garvey. When we return, a trip to the Granite State Baseball Dinner. So we go in depth on the Red Sox-Yankees rivalry of the 1970s, talk hitting with Wade Boggs, and talk about what it's like to pitch with the weight of a city on your shoulders and come out on top with Chris Carpenter. This is the Press Pass on KXL. This is the Press Pass here on KXL tonight, presented by Douglas Leonard and Garvey and NHLawOffice.com. And this segment of the show brought to you by Riverbend Community Mental Health and Choices and Addiction Recovery Services. Riverbend wants you to know the treatment works. For more information, check out RiverbendCMHC.org. Here in the middle segment of the program, we're going to do some baseball. The Granite State Baseball Dinner took place last weekend, and we have some really interesting conversations coming up. We talk hitting with Wade Boggs, talking with Chris Carpenter about how to perform when there's intense pressure. And also a little on the Red Sox-Yankees rivalry of the 70s with Goose Gossage and Bucky Dent. We'll start, though, with Carp.
Always great to see Chris Carpenter here at the Granite State Baseball Dinner, something he's done throughout the course of his career and obviously afterwards now being retired. And what does this night mean to you, and how much do you look forward to coming back?
Yeah, it's definitely a great night every year. It's continued to grow each and every year, which is great. And, the amount of money that we're raising for the charities that are involved, and to watch it, like I said, expand into what it has become over the years is great.
There's been so many great players who have come to be a part of this event, with Wade Boggs, Goose Gossage coming this year. How much do you interact with those guys, and have you enjoyed, talking to Tony Perez and other great players who've come?
Yeah, definitely. It's a great experience for us as players, too, to interact and communicate to one another and see one another. And I grew up watching Wade play and Rich Gedman and guys like that, so... it's been fun to see some of the older players that have come through for me personally to be able to say hello to them, get to know them a little bit personally, and express to them what they meant to me as a kid when I was coming up through the minors and as a high school player too.
What are those interactions like where you have somebody like Wade Boggs you grew up watching as a kid? Wade's obviously watched you pitch in the biggest situations, and you have kind of like that idolization aspect with him, but he also has a reverence to you. Like, how do those interactions usually work?
Yeah, I think, as players, we're all in kind of a similar fraternity, no matter what generation you are in. So, and we have general respect for one another of what we've accomplished and what we've done in the game, because no matter what level you are, obviously at Wade's level as a Hall of Famer, he was had a great career and did a lot of great things. But it's also, he knows how difficult it is just to get there. So to have the opportunity to, like I said, interact with these guys, we all have a general respect for one another. Obviously, some had accomplished more than others, but to get there and be able to even play in the league is pretty cool.
I want to ask you about being a big game pitcher, because a lot of kids will look at the moment that they're in, whether it's in high school, whether it's even younger than that, and that moment means so much to them. They want to maximize that moment. So for you, how did you go about doing it, whether is at the younger level or at the highest level, in order to get your best performance in those spots?
Yeah, I think it comes with experience, one, and it comes with a lot of help from other teammates that have taught me throughout the years of what to expect in those situations, coaches what to expect in those situations, and then the ability to rise up and pitch. And really, it's the difference of being able to control yourself emotionally and mentally to be able to pitch in those situations and not make it bigger than it really is, to be honest with you.
How would you control your emotions specifically? Because I think that's the most important thing for a player, because they have the ability, they have the potential, that's why they're there in that moment. But at times you can get too amped up, you can get too nervous, a lot of different things can happen. So what would you do specifically to try to control your emotions?
Yeah, a lot of self-talk. I would definitely go through the scenarios of what it all looked like. Ultimately, it's a game. You're going out to compete against some of the greatest players in the world. but it is a game. And as long as I knew that I could prepare myself, go out there and be the best I could that night, I can't have any other excuses or any other worries about it. It's just that I'm going to go out and do the best I can. So a lot of self-talk, just talking myself into it.
So having expectations and having those kind of that preparation in your mindset, knowing, or at least thinking you're knowing what's going to take place, did that ease other aspects of, you know, your emotions? Is that the most important thing, having the expectations taken care of?
Yeah. Again, the expectation level, right?
It was like it's kind of the mental side of, like, not necessarily tricking yourself into thinking that you're superbly prepared, but putting yourself, your mind at ease that you think you're prepared and know what's going
to
happen.
So again, it's preparing to know that I have done everything I can before this game.
And letting go.
To give myself an opportunity to compete. And I can't concern myself with anything else but competing. Now, if I had regrets or I didn't work hard enough or I didn't prepare myself well enough before going into the competition, then I have a problem. But I just made sure that when I was going into that competition that I did everything I could to make sure I was prepared in that moment and then allow me to compete. And whatever happens, whatever the results are going to happen, it is what it is. There's nothing I can do about that except for go out and execute.
Great. Thanks, Carp. Great to see you. Yeah, appreciate it.
Wade Boggs was simply an amazing hitter. His ability to serve the ball out to left field, use the Green Monster, and his selective eye and ability to barrel, you know, the baseball and consistently get on base were amongst the best of all time. He and I talked with Wade Boggs about the art of hitting.
When you see a great hitter, what do you look for in that individual? When you, a guy you like watching, what do you see specifically from them that makes them a great hitter?
Well, I think the biggest thing is contactability. Guys that don't swing and miss. You know, work the count a little bit. And, you know, that's the misnomer about all of the sabermetrics and everything like that, is that guys are sitting there and, well, they don't really worry about the average. Mm-hmm. Well, if you don't have a high average, you don't have a high on-base percentage, nobody's scoring any runs. Mm-hmm. You know, in order for a guy to drive in 100 runs, he's got to. I mean, you look at Altuve and, you know, guys of that caliber, and, you know, they hit for high average and power and stuff. I mean, they've revolutionized the game. And Cabrera, when he won the Triple Crown, you know, he's got average and power. So,
is there any frustration in watching the game today?
Yeah, I don't watch it very much. Yeah. I don't watch it very much. You know, any time that you have more strikeouts than hits in a month, something's wrong with the game. Mm-hmm. And I think that it needs to be addressed. And, you know, I mean, if I was a pitcher nowadays, I'd be licking my lips, because all you have to do is throw a high fastball at some of these guys, and you're very welcome. I mean, it's really crazy.
Do you enjoy watching Mookie hit, and does he fall into the line of what you were describing? I mean, he's describing similar to you in terms of his eye, hand coordination, selectiveness. He obviously drives the baseball a little bit more, but you hit for a higher average. Do you see any comparison there between how he approaches hitting and how you did?
Well, I think his career will be defined in a few more years.
Yeah.
You can't define him in 1 year, his MVP year. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's Rome wasn't built in a day. And he's a great player. He's going to do great things in the game. And, you know, just whether or not he's going to get rewarded for being a free agent or staying in Boston.
It's been said that you could foul the ball off if you wanted to and wait for the pitch that you wanted. And if you didn't like a pitch here, you weren't going to be able to drive to the opposite field. You'd foul a couple off till you got the pitch that you wanted to take to the opposite field. Is that something that is kind of an urban legend, or was that a consistent approach for you?
Well, having the ability to wait so long and recognize pitches, and if it was a borderline pitch, you're welcome, with two strikes, then swing late, foul it off. Every time I swung, I sort of made contact. So if it was close and going to be a borderline strike and I couldn't really do anything with it, just swing late and hit it over the third base dugout.
So when you were selective at the plate, would you early in the count be waiting for a specific pitch and be able to know where it was coming based upon arm angle and such, and wait for, you know, the pitch that you wanted, and that was be selective early and foul off late and would get to the pitch that you wanted during the course of the at bat one way or the other?
No, I was C ball hit ball.
Is it?
So it really didn't I wasn't really looking for one thing or another, and so whether it came 1-0 or 2-1 or 1-2 or 2-2, you're very welcome. So I really, I wasn't a guess hitter. I didn't go up looking fastball or anything like that. So I just see the ball, and if it was a good pitch to do something with, then you.
Your kinship with Tony Gwynn has been, you know, well documented, and that both of you were similar hitters in that era. Who, other than Gwynn and, you know, perhaps Ted Williams, were individuals that you enjoyed talking hitting with? And did you feel you could talk hitting with just anybody, or was there certain individuals that understood it and had the same mechanics that you needed to kind of talk about it with?
Well, the funny part about it was I've never talked hitting with Tony Gwynn.
Really?
The only guy I've ever talked hitting with was Ted Williams. I mean, other than Walt Raniak or something like that. I've never really talked hitting with George Brett or Rod Carew or anybody like that.
The final thing would be the greatest hitter that you've seen. Was it Gwynn? You mentioned Rod Carew.
Yeah. Well, I've played in an era with some great hitters. George Brett, Rod Carew. I mean, you know, we have battles back and forth. And I played in an era with a lot of great hitters.
That is Wade Boggs right there. Let's get into the Red Sox-Yankees rivalry a little bit and talk with one of the great closers of all time. He threw the ball hard and was one of the most intimidating pitchers on the hill. He's a Hall of Famer. He's Goose Gossage.
So what's it like for you to go to these events? I know you do a lot of that. Getting to talk to, you know, you're here with Bucky, you see Wade Boggs, and a guy like Chris Carpenter. Like, what is it like for you to get to talk to the former players like yourself?
Well, I mean, you know, we're all a fraternity, and you know, you're a baseball player, we're in that fraternity, and it just seems like we've known each other forever. When you do meet somebody that you've never met before, it's still that strong fraternity. It's just like fans, you know, these fans, I get to do a lot of these things, and it's all about the fans, you know. They're customers of ours. We take care of the fans. I'm not quite sure these young kids understand it today, but that was one of the torches that I think has stopped being passed about how you take care of the fans. And, you know, that was made clear to me at an early point in my career, my first year in a big leagues, man. Chuck Tanner set the record straight.
That's a good point, because I feel like, particularly with the netting that's been put up, it creates an environment, and I understand the fan protection, I think that's important, but it creates an environment where it feels like the fans are away from the players even more, because the fans used to come up along the side and be able to get an autograph during stretch or if you're going out to throw a bullpen, but now there's that netting that's in the way, and it seems like it's kind of a metaphor, if you will, for what's taking place with the fans paying big money but being separate from the players.
Well, you know, everything they want, you know, to get as close to the action as they possibly can now. And they're building these ballparks. They're small ballparks. That's why the home run thing is just out of freaking hand. But that's another subject. But, you know, they're building these ballparks so small, and the fans are so close to the game now. And ironically, they wanted them closer. Now they're closing them out with the netting.
Right.
You know, it's a barrier between watching the game in a clean sense of, I've never liked, baseball was meant to be played on grass. I hated the multi-stadium or multi-purpose stadiums back in the day where they played football, baseball, and baseball was meant to be played on grass and it was meant to be played outside.
Yeah, there's no question.
So, now that they're building all these ballparks a lot closer, now they've become dangerous.
Yeah.
You know, back in the day, sure, you were close, but you weren't as close. You're probably 3 or 4 feet closer now than any of the closest stadiums there were. And there was, you know, you had time to protect yourself from a line drive. Today, you don't.
Plus, there's so much distractions, people on phones and stuff that wasn't there before either. But that's a completely different subject.
Yes.
But I've covered the Red Sox since 2002. And during that time period, there was a great rivalry in 03, 04 between the Red Sox and Yankees. But I was told over and over again that it just wasn't like it was in the 70s. Today, I don't really feel like there's much of a rivalry between the two teams, period. But 03, 04, there was certainly a lot of animosity between the two teams. But what was it like in the 70s, and what was the specific distaste that you had for each other?
Well, you know, today it's become a love fest. You know, around the cage now, everybody's stretching and doing their thing, and everybody's hugging and loving each other. It's like, man, we hated those guys, and they hated us. There was a hell of a respect that came. I can only speak for me, but I could talk for all the Yankees. We had a hell of a respect when we went into Fenway Park to play these guys, and those were great, great baseball teams that we played against, and great athletes and great players. Freddie Lynn and Darrell Evans and Dwight Evans and, Boggsy and Petrocelli first and, Burleson and Short, you know, wow.
Yeah.
You know, Fisk, and Yaz, oh, Jesus, you know. There was a mutual respect, but we hated them, and it was good old-fashioned hardball.
And speaking
we
of
weren't
that,
allowed to talk to
right.
We didn't want to talk to them.
Yeah.
I didn't want to know them. I thought that took the edge away from me. I didn't want to know hitter.
How would you go about pitching guys? Was it your strength and you were going to go with that no matter what? Or would you see a guy like Rice and say, maybe I should give him something away, or Yaz something away, as opposed to going right at him?
Well, hey, I ain't going to throw it down the middle. I'm going to try to stay out of the middle of the plate. That's where you get hurt. So, you know, the old theory of high a tight, low and away, it doesn't change. It hasn't changed. It's not rocket science. You just have to make those pitches when they're called upon to make them, you know, in big situations. And you can't hope that it goes in that spot. You've got to will it. I mean, it's got to be there.
That's one of the interesting things about analytics is that, you know, you look at the hot and cold zones, and it's pretty consistent. High and tight is bad, and low and away is bad, no matter who the hitter is. And you look at this year's postseason as well, and I thought of you a lot because of the way you've talked about, you know, the game today and how you feel about it. And there's been all this introduction of analytics and discussion about that, but things remain pretty simple. If you have really good starting pitching and you have timely hitting, you're going to win championships and a good back end of the bullpen. And things may change, home runs may be hit, but that remains consistent throughout really the course of the history of the game.
Well, you're seeing in the World Series the worst situational hitting that I have ever seen from a team in the World Series, and that was the Houston Astros. They came up with ducks on the pond. They tried to hit balls into the seats, swinging out of their ass, instead of just making contact and getting one run, and then making the merry-go-round continue. You know, now it's home run. It's like the NBA. It's either a slam dunk, a three, or that's it. There's no play action. There's nothing, you know. Baseball's becoming the same way. Feast or famine. I wanted to ask Cashman what the launch angle was on Altuve's ball off of Chapman.
Yeah, that's a good one.
I don't need a launch angle or somebody to tell me, or I never wondered what the hell the launch angle was when Brett hit the ball in the upper deck at Yankee Stadium off of me. You know, it's out of the ball. You know, what is that? These guys are stealing the game, and they're ruining the game. Situation, beautiful, the part of the game, strategy. You're telling me that in the seventh inning on, and they're pulling the shift around? Are you telling me that Mark Teixeira is not going to lay down a bunt to get on base? If they're giving you a base, they won't even take a base, and they're giving it to them. What kind of game is this? I can't even watch it anymore in a phony-ass strike zone on the TV. You know, I don't need a square to show me the – take it away. I don't want to play a video game. I'll go down to the arcade if I want to play a video game.
As a Hall of Famer, I want to ask you about Dwight Evans, who is eligible to go in this year. We're going to learn in the next couple of days about whether or not he's going into the Hall of Fame. In your view, is he, without question, Hall of Famer?
You know, I haven't even addressed it at all or even thought. I thought he's one of the greatest players I ever played. You know, outfielders, throwing, hitting. He was a great player. And I haven't looked at his stats, but I've always thought of him as a, you know, like he could be in the Hall of Fame. Yeah, and I, you know, I don't get the voting. I really don't understand it. I think a lot of riders play games with it. I think it should, something should be done with these guys. You know, Mariano, you know, gets all of a sudden Mariano, he's the greatest one inning pitcher ever. That's how he ended up being a unanimous 100% of the vote. You know, it's bullshit. He's the greatest one inning pitcher of all time. How else would you categorize it?
No, it's true. So do you think he was a Hall of Famer though, but just not unanimous?
No, I'm not getting on his career, right. But just, you know,
also what he was,
is that saying
do?
He's the greatest pitcher of all time?
Right.
When Cy Young and Steve Carlton and all the guys that did what they did didn't get a unanimous vote, and then a one inning pitcher does, it's all bull's vote is a bull's, you know. So that's all. You know, not to say, and then you got steroid guys in the Hall of Fame. You know, I think they all ought to come clean. I think they all ought to come clean and for the sake of the game.
Yeah, Goose gets pretty passionate talking about the game of baseball. There's not much question in regards to that. Let's talk with Bucky Dent. I mean, he is synonymous with, obviously, the home run in 1978. A light-hitting shortstop who finds a way to beat the Red Sox. One of the reasons that the Red Sox lost in the playoff game in 78. And that, you know, was something that epitomized the curse to a lot of individuals. Of all the people who could hit a home run to beat the Red Sox, Bucky Dent, really? Bucky bleeping Dent?
So you are one of the most infamous people in New England and in Boston for the tremendous moment back in 1978. Did you ever anticipate that you would have that type of moment throughout the course of your career? And what has it meant to you afterwards that to hear about that home run over and over again and be synonymous with that?
Well, it's history, you know, and when two teams like New York and Boston come to one game playoff, you know, things are going to happen, you know, and I think you play your whole life for big games, big moments. And, you know, that home run was a big moment, and I'm just proud to be a part of history and be a part of a great game like that, you know. As far as my new middle initial in Boston, I carry it proudly because, you know, it's something that, you know, they nicknamed me, but I think it's out of more of a love-hate respect.
Yeah, it's one of those things in sports where there's certain players that are remembered throughout the course of time. In baseball, you may have an individual that was a great 300 hitter. They had 3,000 hits, and they may get forgotten through the course of time. But a player like you will be remembered forever because of that one hit. And is that something that you are comfortable with and love, or you're like, you know, I wish they remembered me more, you know, for what my career was, as opposed to this one moment in a snapshot of time?
Well, I like I said, I think sports is a game of moments, big moments, and you know, throughout history, you know, like Bobby Thompson and Ralph Branca, you know, New York, Boston doesn't happen very often with a one-game playoff. I don't know if you'll see it ever again. But the intensity of that game, the two cities, what it meant, you know, back then to win the division and go on, it was a special day. And plus it was on a Jewish holiday, which it was like everybody was at home watching the game. And I still love hearing people come up to me 41 years later saying, hey, you know, you broke my heart, or, you know, you made my life, you know, with that home run. You know, it's still fun to hear the stories.
I feel like, you know, and I covered the 2003 and 4 Yankees Red Sox rivalry, and I feel like there was a good degree of animosity between the two teams. But looking back at the 70s, it seems like those two teams actually did hate each other, and perhaps, you know, certain guys on the team that hate each other. How would you define, you know, the rivalry in terms of the dislike between the two teams in 77, 78?
Well, I think it goes back to the history, you know, of Boston never winning. And, you know, and plus, you know, back then free agency was just starting. So, you know, your players stayed on the same team for a long time. So, you know, there was that ability to love, hate another team because of the history, you know, of losing all the time, of having that on your back and stuff like that. Plus, the two teams didn't like each other. They just didn't like each other. And, you know, when you have that, you know, you have explosive moments, you know, where something, you know, a pitch inside or somebody get hit, we'll set something off. But, you know, back then, the rivalry was really intense. I don't think it's as intense as it is. It was back then because they play each other too many times now, I think.
Final thing on Dwight Evans, who is eligible to go into the Hall of Fame. We're going to learn about that here in the next few days, whether he's going to go in. When you look at him, do you see a Hall of Famer? And is he one of the best that time period that's not currently in the Hall of Fame?
Oh, yes, he was. He was a great, great player. You know, great, great outfielder. You know, he did a lot of super things. So I'm hoping, you know, you always hope for guys, you know, to get in that you played against, you know, and that you know did outstanding things. And he was a top flight player back then.
Thanks, Bucky.
You got it.
Yeah, appreciate it.
That's Bucky Dent. This is the Press Pass here on KXL tonight, presented by Douglas Leonard and Garvey, and that segment of the show brought to you by Riverbend Community Mental Health. All right, quickly right now, let's bring in Dave DiNocchio, a resident sports expert from Boston.com. The segment of the show tonight presented by the Prescription Center and, of course, the Press Pass presented by Douglas Leonard and Garvey and NHLawOffice.com. This is going to be a very interesting matchup for them on Sunday night against the Houston Texans because the Texans are a snowball type of team. They can go one way or the other. For the Patriots, this is not a game that they, quote-unquote, have to have. But the Baltimore Ravens are nipping right at their heels. They have a huge game on Sunday as well against the San Francisco 49ers in Baltimore. What are your feelings on this one?
I'm a little concerned based on the way the week's unfolded for the Patriots. It's always sort of weird to have the holiday in the middle, but that's something they deal with every year, unless you plan on Thanksgiving, which also adds an element of weirdness to the week. But you know, they had eight guys absent for practice on Wednesday because of illness. They had a couple guys that were even practicing with illness. Then Thursday, the news comes out that Nick Folk, the kicker, undergoes an appendectomy. So that means they're likely on to their fourth kicker of the season on Sunday. And I was starting to feel okay about the kicking situation. I don't know how much concern people got from those two misses on Sunday, but I thought Folk had been okay. He'd been solid, so that's another wrinkle. I'm a little more concerned than when we talked earlier in the week, I'll admit that.
No, I agree. I think the situation, Folk, and discussion of whether or not Bailey, who kicked in high school, is going to be field goal kicker on Sunday, that's really concerning for the Patriots. Yeah, Folk was... he was fine. I mean, I would have liked to see him hit one of those from, 45-plus, but... you know, it's a difficult day weather-wise, and you can give him kind of a break on that. So, yeah, we'll see what the Patriots do in that realm. The illness, which is making its way through the Patriots locker room, is also concerning at this point. And, again, we've talked about it before. The team that needs to win at home a lot of times in these games wins. I mean, we saw it last year on kind of a continuous basis of a team's that – whether it was the Lions earlier in the year or the Dolphins or whomever, a team that was like in a spot where they felt like they needed to win and they were at home, a lot of times they win in this league. And the Texans were absolutely embarrassed by the Baltimore Ravens, and they're coming into this contest at 7-4, and they need a win. Patriots at 10-1, and it is just trending towards a game where the Patriots are challenged. And with Houston, it seems like they're either really good or really bad.
Yeah, and I do think the fact that the Ravens play at 1 o'clock on Sunday, you know, it'd be interesting to see if it has an impact. Coming out of last week, one of my big takeaways was how mentally tough the Patriots are, and that the circumstances, the conditions, whatever they seem to need, whatever the scenario presents, they've been able to deliver this season. I think that's the biggest reason they're 10-1. So it's not like I think they're going to let down if they get, right, some help from the 49ers. But if Baltimore goes out once again and looks as dominant as they've looked, or at least, wins the game and keeps pace with them and stays right on the Patriots' heels, I think that's got to be a motivator for the Patriots on Sunday night. That does sort of move them in terms of where they are with desperation and where they are in terms of importance, because they've been to Baltimore. They know what that circumstance was like. They know how difficult that was, and they know how good the Ravens are playing right now. I don't think Baltimore is a place they want to go back to. And in order to make sure that that doesn't happen, the only way to do it, it seems, you know, unless they get some help, will be to run the table, because Baltimore's got the tiebreaker. They're one game back. If San Francisco can beat Baltimore on Sunday afternoon, you know, the Patriots are a little less desperate. But, you know, going from the West Coast to the East Coast, going up against that freight train that is Lamar Jackson, I think Baltimore is going to win that game, and I think they're going to keep the pressure on the Pats.
Agreed. You've been listening to the Press Pass tonight here on KXL, presented by Douglas Leonard and Garvey. That segment of the show presented by the Prescription Center.